So that was Ralph Nader in the summer of 2000 in Philadelphia on the floor of the Republican convention. Everyone, the journalists migrated. He basically held a news conference there. We brought him on to present commentary. Ralph, you ran for president four times. Your thoughts on what you call the duopoly, and at this point, when people are talking about this election, which could ultimately be between Biden and Trump, calling it the most important presidential election perhaps in history, what are your comments on that?
Well, what you did in 2000, Democracy Now!, has never been done before or since. You basically got me inside the Republican convention to provide some sort of counterpoint and alternative to the mass media that was there. I was as astonished as anybody. And it didn't take long for me to be escorted out of the convention center. But you got the job done. And what is the job? The job is to give more voices and choices on the electoral ballot to the American people. This is crazy what's going on. The gap between the Democrats and Republicans has narrowed tremendously from the days of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Republican Party, say, in the 1930s. The Democrats have rhetoric on environmental issues, labor issues, but they don't really use their muscle in Congress, and they should have long ago landslided the Republican Party, which is the worst ever in history on so many issues that have been reported by you and others. So what do people do? First of all, they have to organize Congress Watch lobbies back home between elections so that elections become more meaningful, so that people start seeing that on the table is corporate crime enforcement, the end of corporate welfare, the establishment of arms control treaties, and a Department of Peace that Dennis Kucinich is supporting. He's now running for Congress again from Ohio. There's so many areas that were put on an effort in 2022, which we called winningamerica.net. You people can go and see it, showing that so many of the major concerns of the American people, it doesn't matter whether they label themselves conservative or liberal when they are trying to feed their families, when they're trying to get through the day where they live, work, and raise their families. Ideology of divide and rule doesn't quite work with them. But we tried to do that with winningamerica.net. We put the whole range of progressive policies that have huge majoritarian support. That's the hidden story. There's a lot of left-right support for a living wage, for universal health insurance, for cracking down on corporate crime, for changing the whole ridiculous tax system.
Ralph, Juan wants to get one more question in before the end of the show. Juan?
Yeah. Ralph, I wanted to ask you about the Israel's war on Gaza. You had a recent column headline, what the mass media needs to cover regarding Israel-Gaza conflict. Could you lay out, we only have about a couple of minutes, if you could lay out your key points.
Well, the key points is that, and this is not very often recognized, is there are five federal laws that the U.S. and Israel are violating by unconditional and unconstitutional support of this illegal genocidal war in Gaza. The Foreign Assistance Act, the Arms Export Control Act, the U.S. War Crimes Act, the Leahy Law Protecting Human Rights, and the Genocide Convention Implementation Act. And I think we have to bring the focus back home. We're the arch enabler of this massive slaughter in Gaza, which seems to have no end, and is over 100,000 people and children dead so far, and many, many more dying by the hour. There's a huge undercount of the fatality toll. So I've urged people to listen to Democracy Now!'s in-person interviews of these doctors, and I just read, Amy, the article you and Dennis Moynihan wrote about the on-site in the hospitals being blown apart, witnesses by the doctors who can't have come back to the United States and Canada. We've got to get the support for the senators who have already, five senators have called for direct aid bypassing Israel, direct U.S. humanitarian aid with international organizations in Gaza right now.
Ralph, we're going to have to leave it there. We want to thank you so much. I hate to cut you off on your 90th birthday, but what else is new? Ralph Nader, longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, former presidential candidate. Happy 90th birthday. Founder of the print-only monthly newspaper Capitol Hill Citizen. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations of programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the first Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon Employment Department will be offline until Monday when they debut a new web system. Oregon joins 8 other states in a lawsuit to block a merger between grocery giants Kroger and Albertsons. And in national news, social programs in California aimed at keeping people who were formerly incarcerated from going back behind bars are working. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 27th, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. The Oregon Employment Department will be going offline for several days. The department will be pivoting to a new, easier-to-use online system for unemployment benefits. It's called Francis Online, and it's set to go live on March 4th. Until then, though, people cannot file, restart, or check or make changes to their claim information. New unemployment claims close today at 5 o'clock, and the last day to file a weekly unemployment claim for the past week is Wednesday at 5. All unemployment insurance phone lines will also be closed Wednesday throughout Friday. The new system is set to go live at 8 a.m. on Monday, March 4th. It's mobile-friendly, and it's hoped that it will be easier for people to check and edit their claims online. The Supreme Court hears arguments on whether social media can restrict content. Biden advisors point to anti-democracy speeches at CPAC, and the president heads to the U.S.-Mexico border appealing to voters on immigration and border issues. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
If the government's doing it, then content moderation might be a euphemism for censorship. If a private party is doing it, content moderation is a euphemism for editorial discretion. And there's a fundamental difference between the two.
Paul Clement is representing big social media companies as the Supreme Court grapples with internet free speech questions, specifically laws from Texas and Florida that would bar platforms from restricting content. The Republican-led states outlawed content moderation when Twitter, Facebook, and others banned former President Donald Trump over efforts to overturn the 2020 election and inciting his supporters to storm the Capitol on January 6th. Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act generally protects social media companies from being sued over content. Justice Clarence Thomas questioned whether that means they are like phone companies who just carry the messages for everyone, or like newspapers that have the right to decide what is said.
I've been fortunate or unfortunate to have been here for most of the development of the internet. And the argument under Section 230 has been that you're merely a conduit. Now you're saying that you are engaged in editorial discretion and expressive conduct.
Trump and his followers are again drawing fire for authoritarian rhetoric. Jack Posobiec told the conservative crowd at CPAC, "We are here to overthrow democracy and finish the January 6th insurrection." Former Obama advisor David Axelrod tells CNN that President Joe Biden's campaign needs to make sure every American knows about the Trump's movement's fascist tendencies.
If I were the Biden campaign, I would pay to have every American see the CPAC convention, because the thing that has been thwarting Republicans in the midterms and since has been this impression of the Republican Party as an extreme party.
Meanwhile, both Biden and Trump will go to the border to highlight the importance of immigration policies. Biden will travel to Brownsville, Texas, and meet with immigration agents. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says in his second visit to the border, Biden will again stress his frustration that congressional Republicans killed a hard-fought bipartisan border compromise.
He wants to make sure that he puts his message out there to the American people so that they know. They know that what we tried to do with the Senate in a bipartisan way, a border security deal, and obviously a deal that deals with the immigration system, and we tried to get that done.
Arizona has mailed out ballots for next month's presidential preference election to Democrats and Republicans. In part to reduce mistrust and deal with election denial, Secretary of State Adrian Fontes says all voting machines have just been tested.
We've had teams deployed across the entire state, making sure that those equipment are ready for your ballots.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Oregon joins eight other states and the Federal Trade Commission in a lawsuit to block the merger of two grocery giants, Kroger and Albertsons. The lawsuit was filed by the FTC on Monday. It says the merger would violate the federal Clayton Act by lessening competition. Analysis from the FTC and the Oregon Department of Justice found that competition between Kroger and Albertsons-owned grocery stores led to competitive prices and better quality. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum said, quote, "If big grocery stores are allowed to reduce competition this way, they can charge higher prices for food for no good reason and reduce services, including in their pharmacies." Rosenblum continued, quote, "They can also slow the growth of employee wages or even reduce some of those wages. Working conditions and employee benefits can suffer as well. In short, there's no good for consumers or workers in this proposed merger and a lot of bad," end quote. Kroger owns 51 Fred Meyer's stores and 4 QFC stores in Oregon. Albertsons owns 96 Safeway locations and 25 Albertsons in the state. The other states joining the lawsuit are Arizona, California, Illinois, Maryland, Nevada, New Mexico, Wyoming, and the District of Columbia. Colorado and Washington have filed separate lawsuits to block the merger in their respective state courts. This week is Invasive Species Awareness Week, focusing on harms these plants and creatures can do to the environment. Eric Tegedoff has more in Idaho.
It's National Invasive Species Awareness Week, and plants and critters that aren't native to the Northwest are wreaking havoc on some landscapes, including in Idaho. A wide variety of species are considered invasive, from insects and amphibians to weeds and mollusks. Nick Zerflu is Bureau Chief for the Invasive Species, Noxious Weeds, and Range Programs with the Idaho State Department of Agriculture. He says these plants and animals can throw the environment out of whack.
When you put in a species that is not known to occur, that doesn't have the natural checks and balances from their native range, then they can do quite well, create monocultures, and change things like the fire regime or change things like water quality and how we utilize the landscape.
Zerflu says some species of concern in Idaho include cheatgrass, bullfrogs, Asian carp, and zebra and quagga mussels. National Invasive Species Awareness Week lasts through March 3rd. Zerflu notes many of these species have a direct effect on Idaho's economy.
Whether that's impacting our way of life, irrigation, agriculture, hydropower, municipal water systems, the way that we recreate on the landscape, that is ever shifting because of the way invasive species move into areas.
Zerflu says there are a few things Idahoans can do to prevent the spread of invasive species, such as knocking weed seeds off their boots after hiking and planting native species in gardens. There is also a campaign to keep zebra and quagga mussels from spreading in the state because they can clog drain pipes and hurt fish populations. Zerflu says mussels can spread especially on watercraft.
Really taking the time to clean, drain, and dry water-related equipment, whether it's a paddleboard or a kayak or your recreational watercraft, clean, draining, and drying is very effective.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The credit card company Capital One is proposing to buy Discover for $35 billion in stock in a deal that was announced last week. The merger would make Capital One one of the biggest U.S. credit card companies in terms of loans. It would become the third largest in terms of purchase volume, and it would also give it access to Discover's valuable payment network. Consumer advocates and certain lawmakers are warning that the merger would be bad for credit card users who already are under pressure from high interest rates and record debt. Adam Rust is the director of financial services at the Consumer Federation of America, a national network of consumer advocacy groups. He said, quote, "We should be worried about the functionality of the credit card market in general. This merger probably heightens that," end quote. If the deal goes through, he warned, it would whittle down consumer options to shop around for the best credit cards. A recent report by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau found that the 25 biggest credit card issuers already charge interest rates about 8 to 10 points higher than small and medium-sized banks and credit unions. This will be the first major test of a proposed bank merger since the Biden administration made an executive order promoting competition in 2021, and since two mid-sized California banks collapsed last year. Total consumer debt in the U.S. currently stands at $17.5 trillion, and the average credit card interest rate in the U.S. is at about 24%, according to LendingTree. That's the highest rate since they began tracking rates in 2019. California has just released an evaluation of social programs funded by Proposition 47. It found that people who had been incarcerated are much less likely to recidivate. Suzanne Potter has the details.
Programs intended to reduce the chances that someone will end up back behind bars are working, according to a new analysis of California state data. A new report finds that people who participated in a social program funded by Proposition 47 had a recidivism rate of 15.3%, compared with 35-45% for people traditionally incarcerated by the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. Linda Penner chairs the California Board of State and Community Corrections, which produced the report.
These results indicate that Prop 47 is delivering the results voters wanted. Safer communities where individuals who commit low-level crimes are directed to housing, employment, mental health, and substance use services instead of prison.
Proposition 47 raised the threshold for a theft to qualify as a felony, which lowered the number of people getting jail time. It has saved the state $800 million in incarceration costs since it passed in 2014, money that was reinvested in social programs that help justice-involved people get back on their feet. Sean Huff works with Shields for Families, Inc., a nonprofit social services organization in South Central Los Angeles. He applauds the focus on crime prevention.
When you are able to address those issues, you're attacking some of the root causes of crime, and you keep people from feeling like they have no other choice but to go back to crime or to commit crime. But you really help to address the issues that led them to make those decisions in the beginning.
The analysis also found that 60% of people experiencing homelessness who make it through the program end up finding a stable place to live. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Oregon Legislature House Bill 4002 to recriminalize drug possession in the state. Then, a look at the new Portland-set short film, Matinee Baby. At 6 o'clock, it's Eco-Justice Radio. Then at 7, it's KBOO Black History and Futures Month series. Tonight's weather will be cloudy in the metro area, with some strong wind gusts possible and a low of 34. A winter storm warning for the Cascades is in effect until Friday morning. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 51. Today in history, in 1902, American writer John Steinbeck was born. He won the Pulitzer Prize for The Grapes of Wrath, considered to be his masterpiece and a part of the American literary canon. The quote of the day is from Steinbeck, who said, quote, "Time is the only critic without ambition." A moment of silence for awareness of missing and murdered Indigenous people was held at a recent Montana State basketball game. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana continues to rank in the top 10 states in the nation for the number of reported cases of missing and murdered Native women and girls. A presentation at a recent Montana State University Billings women's basketball game used halftime and the power of silence to raise awareness. Yellowstone Public Radio's Orlinda Worthington brings us the story.
Number 10,
at halftime of the MSUB Lady Yellow Jackets game, instead of the usual loud commotion of the jazz band, cheerleaders, and overhead announcements in the Alterowitz gym, there is this. Spectators grew quiet as more than 50 Native American women, men, and children circled the basketball court in silence, each holding a photo of a missing or murdered friend or loved one. Daniel LaForge carried a picture of his sister, the second family member killed by violence.
We're seeking justice for my sister. To this point, we still haven't had a court date to where we've been able to get that justice. So any kind of awareness that we can bring to her situation and help us get that justice is something that we're striving for.
It may seem an unusual pairing, a high-energy basketball game coupled with the somber issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Randy Bear Don't Walk is the Native Success Coordinator for MSUB. He explains the significance.
Basketball is huge in Native American culture, and it's a way to draw the community closer. It's a way to present our plight that we battle on a daily basis. You know, the missing and murdered Indigenous woman is a huge issue in our community, and a lot of times it's swept under the rug, if you will.
Raising awareness of MMIW started the game, too. The MSUB team entered the gym wearing red T-shirts with the phrase, "No More Stolen Sisters." The change in warm-up gear was in support of the halftime event, sponsored by Missing and Murdered Indigenous People Billings. More than 50 missing or murdered Indigenous women were honored during the silent halftime.
Thank you to all you brave people who came out today.
In Billings, I'm Orlinda Worthington.
The U.S. Department of Energy Office of Indian Energy is hosting the 2024 Tribal Clean Energy Summit this week in Temecula, California. The biannual event brings together tribal leaders, community members, and energy partners from across the country to focus on clean energy development for tribal communities. More than 700 people are expected to attend this year's summit. On Tuesday, U.S. Secretary of Energy Jennifer Granholm will deliver remarks. According to the DOE, she's expected to discuss the administration's commitment to strengthening engagement with tribes to build a clean energy economy. The summit is intended to provide a space for tribal leaders to build networks and explore clean energy projects. The DOE says these types of projects can create jobs and enhance climate resilience. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute is holding a public ceremony this week to welcome home a historic Chilkat robe to Alaska. It was purchased by six people in the lower 48 states and donated to the Institute. The piece is estimated to be at least 150 years old. The ceremony will include a special recognition of the donors and weavers who assisted in securing its return. The event will feature a traditional spirit dance to welcome it home and bring life back into the robe. Chilkat weaving is unique to Northwest Coast cultures and functions as a clan or ceremonial object within the Native community. The ceremony is scheduled for Friday afternoon in Juneau and will also be streamed online. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Legislation in Massachusetts aims to restrict crisis pregnancy centers from engaging in deceptive tactics to prevent people from having abortions. The clinics don't provide comprehensive reproductive health care, and they actually outnumber abortion providers in New England more than 2-1. Catherine Carley reports from Boston.
Legislation in Massachusetts would ban some of the tactics used by crisis pregnancy centers to prevent people from having abortions. Many of the centers have the words medical or health in their names, but don't offer licensed reproductive medical care. Lori Veninger, an organizer with the Indivisible Massachusetts Coalition, says the centers advertise free tests and ultrasounds and then pressure women into continuing their pregnancies.
If they were a business, that would be curtailed by existing laws about deceptive advertising. But these places are religious nonprofits.
Veninger says the crisis centers are often located near abortion providers where anti-abortion activists try to lure people their way. Abortion opponents contend the centers simply offer confidential services to those facing unplanned pregnancies. Following complaints, the Department of Public Health recently sent a memo to nearly 30 crisis pregnancy centers regarding state laws and patients' rights. Benninger says Massachusetts is in the crosshairs of what she calls religious extremists, targeting states where abortion remains legal. She says many low-income people are being deceived with potentially dangerous outcomes.
Some of them have told us that they called up and made an appointment because they thought they were going there for an abortion, and then when they got there, didn't get one, and then they had to wait another week to get the appointment at the real clinic.
Benninger says that added week can mean the difference between having a medication abortion or requiring a surgical procedure. A class action lawsuit claims a nurse at the Clearway Clinic in Worcester County failed to inform a patient that her ultrasound showed an ectopic pregnancy, nearly costing the patient her life. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
Oregon could get access to food benefits for nearly 300,000 children during the summer months, but lawmakers first have to approve funding for the program. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
A program that would provide food benefits to kids during the summer still needs funding approval from the Oregon legislature. The state has already approved the summer EBT program, but needs to agree to pay for half of the administrative costs in order to get access to federal funds. It would help the families of nearly 300,000 kids receive about $40 for food each month over the summer. Charlie Krause with Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon says child hunger spikes during the summer months.
When they're fed throughout the school year and they have access to meals throughout the school year, it's only fair that they have access to food throughout the summer. Their income level doesn't drastically change in the summer. They still need access to support and access to food.
Krause says there have been bipartisan calls to fund the program. The state would get access to about $35 million a year from the federal government for benefits. The legislative session is scheduled to adjourn on March 10th. Matt Newell Chang with Oregon Food Bank says summer EBT benefits would be especially helpful for families in rural areas.
While we love and are big proponents of summer meal sites, we also know that a lot of them are inaccessible. And so this new program was meant specifically to address gaps like that.
Newell Chang says everything else is in place. They just need the final piece from lawmakers.
Ensuring that Oregon contributes its share of the administrative funding makes this all happen and builds on that groundwork. And so basically we're asking legislators to do the right thing for 294,000 kids, make sure that that funding is there so we can get this across the finish line and kids can get the support during the summer.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
1 year ago, a Chinese spy balloon drifted over the U.S. and caused a major rift between the two countries. In hindsight, both governments mismanaged the incident. There are important lessons to be learned. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. This month is the first anniversary of the infamous Chinese spy balloon incident, the unnecessary crisis that set back U.S.-China relations for several months. Everything from the balloon's launch to its shooting down was mismanaged, providing lessons that may or may not have been learned. First of all is the question whether or not deploying the balloon over the U.S. near to a U.S. military base in Montana was a Chinese leadership decision. We're pretty clear now that it wasn't, but at the time it was treated in Washington as though the balloon was the brainchild of Xi Jinping himself. Since then, the Biden administration has reversed course, starting with the president's own assertion that Xi probably did not know about the balloon's mission. He got very upset over it, Biden said in the same off-camera remarks in which he called Xi a dictator. The Biden administration, quote, wants to bury the incident because they know that Xi Jinping really didn't have anything to do with it, that it wasn't some sort of effort against the United States, and that no one intended for it to be over Montana. So said Dennis Wilder, former National Security Council director for China. U.S. officials confirmed 2 weeks after the balloon's destruction that winds had blown it off course. This gets to a more fundamental matter in decision-making here or anywhere. What might initially appear to be a calculated, high-level move by an adversary may turn out to be the ordinary operations of a bureaucracy. In this case, the division of the Chinese military responsible for spy balloons. That reality can be consequential today when we see many Chinese spy balloons over Taiwan. Are they a harassment or a security threat? Second, the incident set off crisis-level accusations from Washington that the balloon was a strategic threat, hence needed to be shot down, and from Beijing that the balloon was for weather forecasting and that the U.S. was engaged in hysterical accusations. Neither accusation was accurate. It was a spy balloon, to be sure, but hardly of the sort that needed to be treated as an imminent threat. The fact, according to the Pentagon, seems to be that the balloon did not carry any special spy technology. But that leads to a third issue. What exactly did the balloon carry? Then Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair Mark Milley said in September that, quote, there was no intelligence collected by that balloon, unquote. The Pentagon backs that claim, saying the balloon, quote, did not collect any intelligence while it transited the U.S. and that it did not transmit any intelligence back to China, unquote. But the Pentagon, which had promised to publicly release all information on the balloon's capability and its data, has never done so, fueling right-wing and other theories about the China threat and a Pentagon cover-up in deference to getting along with China. Thus, the fourth lesson, domestic politics may have had much to do with U.S. decision-making on the balloon flight, or at least that's the accusation from conservatives in Congress. Mike Gallagher, Republican of Wisconsin, the retiring chair of the House Select Committee on China, said in a statement recently, quote, China House, which is the year-old State Department Office of China Coordination, seems to have spent 2023 accommodating the Chinese Communist Party and axing key defensive actions like export controls and sanctions, unquote. That drew a retort from Rick Waters, the Assistant Secretary of State, then in charge of the office. Quote, the idea that in the middle of the balloon incident, where we pulled down Blinken's trip, referring to the trip that Secretary of State Antony Blinken was supposed to make, that we were somehow pulling our punches didn't make sense, he said in an interview. If we had been pulling our punches, we would have gone ahead with the trip, unquote. I disagree. If keeping up the momentum from the Biden-Xi summit in Bali, Indonesia was policy, the Blinken trip should have gone ahead. Instead, the administration acted out of fear of the far right's accusations of being soft on China. Finally, one of the scantily reported upshots of the balloon incident is that China apologized. The Chinese side regrets the unintended entry of the airship into U.S. airspace, the Chinese Foreign Ministry said in a statement. The Biden administration did not acknowledge the apology, a rarity in diplomacy with China. Granted, the apology fell short of saying that the balloon was on a spy mission. Nevertheless, the administration could have accepted the apology, recognized that the balloon was not